Okay, so I started recording. We finished the designs, and also we talked about all kinds of things that can be wrong in the laboratory, right? That was last week. So today, what I want to do is start, it's going to be a group of two classes, today and next week, causal discovery. Causal discovery means discovery, causation from just observations. We did talk about it a little about causality. I'll just remind that in a moment, so that we are not so this fresh. But let me start with causal discovery with these slides. Duplicate, okay. Should start presentation, but I think it is not duplicating. Duplicate, for some reason it ignores all this. Okay, so here we are. For some reason it gave me just a moment. Is this? It keeps okay, let's go get here. Maybe now it will P. Duplicate. Okay. I hope it's okay. Now it's working fine. So it is essentially. I'm going to just briefly review what causal graphs are, Bayesian networks, causal graphs. We talked about them already. Then causal discovery, which is what I'm going to talk about today. Model validation is not something that is relevant to this course, so I'm not going to talk about that. So causality and probability is going to be just a review of what we of what we can say about causation and probability. And then the algorithms, two classes of algorithms, which is going to be in the presentation. So relationship between causation and probability, we talked about it, so it's just going to be a review. And then learning causation from data. Causal graphs, in general, these are very related to a tool known as Bayesian networks. So when we use the software, which you can use, it's a software that is available to academics free of any cost. Bayesian networks are very close to causal graphs. What we have here is a graph of variables and connections between them are causal influences. So when we have, for example, variable obesity, it influences hepatic steatosis. It's a causal influence. Hepatic steatosis can influence the level of triglycerides in the blood. Triglycerides are a component of cholesterol in blood. So these are causal connections. The qualitative part is just the causal structure, but there's also underlying quantitative part, numbers. The numbers are in those graphs. They can be also learned from data And once you have both the graph and the parameters, you can use a model like this in a variety of ways, like in decision support, for example. When there are parents of a node, then we are dealing with conditional probability distributions. So fatigue has as a parent a chronic hepatitis, and fatigue will be specified by a conditional probability distribution, actually a set of conditional probability distributions, depending on the values of the parents. The numbers can come from a variety of sources. Data measurements, like in databases, is what we are going to start with. Bayesian networks are useful because you can perform calculations. If you have a model like this, which is a model of three different liver diseases, you can calculate the probabilities of, for example, chronic hepatitis in an alcoholic patient with jaundice and ascites. I am observing here ascites, jaundice, and alcohol abuse. You see the grounding symbol. And then I can answer the question about what is the probability of chronic hepatitis, which is this node. And the calculation that happens is you can imagine that as a spreading information across the network and calculating the posterior probability here. We can also answer questions like which disease is most likely, which tests should we perform next, etc. Those graphs can be very, very large. This is a graph consisting of 2,100 variables. Many parameters, but they were learned from data, so not a big deal. Joint probability distribution, you see that the connections are also many. It looks like a spaghetti. The parameters, if we were to model the joint probability distribution directly, then in a brute force way, then we would need that many parameters. And that's much, 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 much bigger than the number of atoms in the observable universe. It's an exponential function. So now let me show you what we can do. Maybe I can interrupt this for just a moment and start with the program. Let me... Oops, I don't have... Well, maybe this one will have... Okay, so I'll starting the program Genie. And I'm going to open a data set. Some of this. This is a data set that pretends to be collected in a bank. And there are 10,000 records. And these are variables, the columns. Payment history here. Work history, reliability, and others. And these are individual clients. So there was a client of the bank that had acceptable payment history, justified no work history, like a student, maybe that's why it didn't work, was reliable. These are different measures, debit income, etc. The important thing in the data set is that that last variable, creditworthiness, this client has paid back the loan. And the bank is interested in whether a client will pay back the loan or not. So once I have this, a data set like this, I can learn a model, and that model can be given a causal interpretation. So I'm picking one of the algorithms. In a fraction of a second, the algorithm learned the structure, let me organize it a little bit better. First of all, maybe I can organize it. By graph layout, parent ordering from left to right. This gives us the structure among the variables in our data set. In this learning, I didn't use any information except for the data, just the data. So it gives me the structure, and the structure can be given a causal interpretation. So I can interpret it as causes, like age is a direct cause of creditworthiness, whether somebody will pay back the loan or not. So I can learn the causal structure. If you remember, the experiments were to establish causality. So we conducted experiments to check if something causes something else, like smoking causes cancer. In this case now, we can look at the data set and we can learn from the data the causal structure among the variables. So that's the thing that we are going to talk about. How can we take a data set and then extract the structure? Let me show you something more. The model has also learned the parameters. If I view this as bar chart, let me do the layout again. Maybe a little bit further away from each other. Okay, here is my model. The same structure, I'm just viewing the marginal probability distributions in terms of bars. So now I see the probability distributions over every variable. I can take this model, and of course the first thing is understanding the causal structure. But then I can, suppose I'm interested in this, let me make it a different color. I'm going to make it yellow. This is no. Okay. So I'm interested in the creditworthiness, whether the customer will pay back the loan. And now I can do the calculations the way I showed you on one of the slides. I can ask the client in a form, maybe online form, what is your age? Suppose it's this. I'm double clicking on this, I'm observing this value. Please note that it calculated the new probability of paying back the loan. Profession, high income profession, an engineer. Assets, wealthy. Work history, justified no work. Look, I'm calculating the probability that the customer will pay back the loan. So first I can learn the structure and then I can use it in order to make predictions. The parameters that I showed you on the slide, we can open it up, look at the parameters here. I can open up this one. It has parents, so there will be conditional probability distributions. They were also learned from data, all of these distributions. Together, the parameters and the structure give me a model of the probability distribution. So now the rest of the class is going to be on focusing on how can we do it? How can we do this magic? Because it is like magic. So if you have a data set and if you have structure, for example, you understand the causal connections, what you can do is you can learn the parameters and then you have a complete model. You can also learn from the data, the structure. And this is what you just saw in this demo. The problem of learning is, of causal discovery, is that you have a set of variables. You can call them attributes like in databases. And then there is a data set of measurements of these attributes. So every record is a simultaneous measurement of these attributes. A client has some values for each of these variables. From that, we can learn the structure, which gives us the insight into causal connections, so we can get the causal understanding of what is happening. And then, if we learn the parameters, we can use that in all kinds of prediction systems. We are interested in causality because of two reasons. Causality allows us to predict the effects of manipulation. So if I understand the causal structure, that's why science is interested in causality, because if I know that smoking causes cancer, I can stop smoking, and that should influence the probability of cancer. Or if I understand that pressing that white button will turn on the light, I can do it, yes? So understanding the causality is very, very important, and we use it all the time, really. Drinking water will humidify my body, right? I will feel better. So we understand all that. And the second is, of course, humans, people, like to think in causal terms. So when you want to refine a model like this for practical applications using human expert knowledge, it's convenient to have models that are causal. Of course, it's not surprising that humans are thinking in these terms if causality is so important. Actually, I don't have a good set of slides because we talked about this. We talked about the fact that causality is not used too widely. I think you saw these slides in the beginning of the course. Flu and fever. Let me actually see if I by any chance didn't take a wrong slide. Let me see what I have online here. And this is the materials of the class. Causal graphs, Freud, learning, Bayesian networks, and causal discovery. No, these are absolutely correct slides. Yes, these are absolutely correct slides. So I'm in a way repeating the slides on causality, but that's okay. It's maybe a good that we are doing the review. So causality and probability are related closely. For example, if you have a causal structure, flu causes fever, then the two are going to be dependent probabilistically. So among people who have flu, you will notice more people having fever than in the general population. And the same among people who have fever, you will notice more flu than in the general population. They are going to be dependent on one another. We played at that time with a collection of causal graphs to kind of explain that that relationship. Maybe I'm not going to do that again, but just explain them in the slides. We had the same slides too, but I'm going to go a little bit slower here. So this graph I constructed out of my head. If you remember, I was also saying that graphs are to a large degree subjective. The subjectivity of these graphs is not more disturbing than the subjectivity of science, because scientists also look at the world, they decide what to look at, and that's a subjective decision. If I do an experiment on smoking, I decide, okay, I'm going to look at smoking, I'm going to measure lung cancer, I'm going to write down the IQ and sex of the person, yes, male or female. I'm deciding that. Also, I'm deciding how to measure. So, for example, smoking, I'm going to decide, I'm going to measuring it as a smoker, non-smoker, or maybe the number of cigarettes per day. I'm deciding subjectively. The same here, I have drawn this graph. I decided that these variables are going to be here, 3 causes of flat tire, 4 effects. One of the effects is an accident, can cause a car damage, an injury, and this is more a joke. A knife can also cause injury. We are repeating the slides, kind of going once again, just to review that relationship between causality and probability, because this is going to be important in causal discovery. So knife is meant to be a joke. I added a knife. I could add a gun also here, machete or whatever thing that can cause injury. I was just reiterating the idea that graphs are subjective, the causal graphs are subjective, but they are as subjective as science is. So when you have a graph, then the connections in the graph are going to result in correlations or in general in probabilistic dependence. So for example, glass on the road and flat tire are going to be related, dependent. Those roads that have glass on them are going to have higher incidence of flat tires. Or among people who have flat tire, you will notice that they are riding, where they were riding, there were roads, more roads with glass than people who have good tire, not flat. And then we talked about glass on the road. Sorry, we talked about chains of events, like of variables, like glass causes flat tire causes noise. Then everything on this chain is going to be dependent on one another. The dependence can come also through a common cause that causes both, bumpy feeling and noise. This is captured by an axiom, an assumption. Axiom means an assumption, essentially, called a causal Markov condition. It sounds a little theoretical. I'm not going to get into the deep meaning of that statement. It's enough that we are going to talk about the three consequences of those of that Markov condition. It is an assumption, but used by almost everybody in practice. In fact, large part of that assumption has been known for centuries, for several hundred years. It was formalized this way just 40 years ago, maybe. And there have been people who tried to find counterexamples that it's not holding, but as far as I know, that there are no convincing counterexamples of that assumption. So this is an axiom that is not very controversial, I think. Outside of quantum world, in the macro world, because in the quantum world we know that it's not holding. But quantum world is very funny, very difficult for us to understand, really, at the level of our cognition. So the implications, we played with a collection of different graphs. One of the implications is the chain. If there's a chain of variables connected, it's a directed chain. So the direction of arrows is always in is the same direction. If you have a chain, then everything is going to be dependent on that chain. If there is a common cause, then the effects of that common cause are going to be also dependent on one another. There is also conditional dependence. If you condition on a common effect or common descendant in general, then the causes are going to be dependent. Here is the summary of the implications of Markov condition. These are the three things. This is a very informal way of stating it, but the informal way is enough for a scientist to understand what is happening there. And we have known these things for a long time. The next thing that is important to say is the conditioning thing. If you condition on something, on a variable, then you are breaking the connections. So, for example, if you have a chain like thorns, flat tire, accident, car damage, then conditioning on flat tire will make thorns independent of accident and car damage. One way of viewing it is that there is no more information flowing here, because thorns are causing flat tire, which can cause accident. If you knew thorns, then probability of flat tire was higher, probability of accident was also higher because of that, and car damage was higher also. But once you know that the tire is flat, then thorns will tell you nothing more about the probability of accident. So essentially, conditioning on something breaks the chain. It breaks also the common causes. Bumpy feelings and noise may be related through a common cause, but if you know, if you have observed that cause, they become independent. It's like another example: shoe size and reading ability are dependent very strongly, but it's because of a common cause, age. Children who are young have very small shoes, but they cannot read. When they become older, they have bigger foot, but they can also read better. When you condition on the common cause, the age, so you look only at 7 years old, for example, and then you notice that doesn't matter what their shoe size is, they can all, it's not related to their reading ability. Other factors become important. And the third thing that happens with, so conditioning breaks the common cause connection, but conditioning also makes the causes dependent. That third rule, if you remember. You saw that also, but here is the idea of intervention. Intervention is important if you have a causal graph. If you have a causal graph, for example, a graph like this, you can still use it for predict. When you make a change in it, you intervene, then you make a change in the graph. But still, the rest of the graph that is not changed is still good for predicting what happens. If you intervene into a variable A, then the causes become unimportant. But the effects still are can be predicted from this graph. You may remember this joke. It's the samurai is committing suicide, cutting his belly, and notices a cancer tumor. Now, the idea here is that cancer, COVID, AIDS, and whatever else this samurai has become unimportant because he's killing himself. So as a cause of death, it's unimportant, irrelevant, essentially. If you take a knife, cut the tire, then, of course, the causes of that flat tire become unimportant, because the tire is flat with a knife. But everything else can be still used to predict what happens. You cut the tire is flat, probability of accident is higher, car damage and injury and the other things. That was important in research design, because here, if you have a smoking and cancer, we know that they are related. There is correlation between the two. They noticed that in centuries ago, maybe 19th century, it was well known that people who had lung cancer in hospital, in the ward where people had lung cancer, there were more smokers than in the population. The same people who were smokers, more of them than the general population, got lung cancer. But it can be because of various things. The graph, we don't know the graph yet. Yes, so you saw this graph, this slide. It can be that smoking causes cancer, but genetic factors are also influencing one or the other or both. this is the possibility that the correlation between smoking and cancer is through a common cause. Genetic factors that make people smoke, a preference for smoking, may be the same factors that make them develop cancer. So maybe there's no connection, but just a common cause. Or the connection is the other way, that all these graphs also explain the relationship, probabilistic dependence between lung cancer and smoking. There's a connection here. So you remember this, the true experimental design, I think it was number 4, we use a randomization, a coin, to as an intervention. We flip a coin, and the result of that flip is the only cause of smoking. So perfect manipulation. Then these connections disappear, and in the experiment, if at the end of the experiment, if there is a dependence, it could have been only because of this connection, nothing else. Other things can just add noise, but like genetic factors or asbestos, but they will not change the fact that there is or there is no dependence between these two. If they are dependent, then it can be only because of this cause, this connection. Now, we cannot experiment in this domain, of course. So now the slides are going to be different. The first, these are two quotes. Actually, I listened to the second one, actually wrote it down, and I found this quote. Ronald Fisher is the father of experimental design. The truly experimental design, like this one, was really proposed by Ronald Fisher. He was doubting until his death that there is a causal connection between smoking and lung cancer. He said no experiment was able to show it, so it's just a correlation, not causation. He said, similar to the correlation between apple imports and rates of divorce. In this case, we can think about maybe common cause. Changes in the society. Society becomes more affluent, for example, richer. People become richer, they can afford importing apples from another country. But they also become richer, they care less about the family, maybe, and that raises the rate of divorce. He was a smoker. I think he smoked a pipe. And if I remember correctly, he died of not lung cancer, but the jaw, the gum cancer. This is another funny thing. I actually watched the debate again. You can find it on YouTube. It was a presidential debate. The candidate was George Bush Sr., and this was his running mate, candidate for the vice president office. And this was Al Gore. He was the candidate for vice president of Bill Clinton. That was 1992. And they are TV debates, like in Poland also, between the candidates. And at some point, this guy, Dan Quayle, I forgot his name, forget his name now and then, he was young, but age has nothing to do with it. The press, the media, portrayed him as somebody quite stupid. I think they were exaggerating. You know, the media can do a lot of things. But actually, he was saying sometimes stupid things. So he reminds me of another politician, Polish politician. I keep forgetting his name, just like Quayle. The guy who was, every time they make an interview with him, he's saying something stupid. He was the guy who was, who said, Sześciu Króli. He said also something about Donald Tusk coming on a Rubicon. Donald Tusk przyjedzie na Rubiconiu. What's his name? He started a party. Petru, Richard Petru. So he's kind of, you know, similar guy. I remember that he was also made fun of by the media. I don't know if this is true or not, but he said something like, maybe this is invented, maybe it's fake news, but they were saying that when he visited a Latin American country as vice president, because this was his second term, I think, the debate, he said, oh, what a pity that I didn't study Latin in my high school, because I could talk with you. So this kind of, you know, silly things, but I'm not sure if this is not a fake news. So in the debate, he said, my presidential candidate, George Bush, is absolutely the best because, thanks to him, the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War ended. And Al Gore, who was very quick in conversations, he said essentially that George Bush taking credit for the end of the Cold War is like a rooster taking credit for the daybreak. So essentially, he was referring to correlation, not causation. So the reason why this slide is that the debate, the doubts whether we are dealing with causation or correlation, this is something quite natural for science, which is in case of Ronald Fisher, but also everyday life, we are sometimes saying this is just correlation, not causation. And can we do science by observation? So very enthusiastically, for around 100 years, they pushed away the word causality from statistics. They also pushed it away from research design, which is what this class is about, research design. And it's kind of funny because in research design especially, you need to talk about causality because you are interested in discovering whether there is a whether there is a causal effect. An experiment like this is essentially aiming at establishing, is there a connection here or not? This is where the question mark. So can we do it in science? Experimentation is not always possible. And we talked about this, remember there was experimental design, but there was also quasi-experimental design where we cannot experiment. And there are also sciences where you cannot experiment. For example, astronomy. How do you experiment in astronomy? You cannot intervene, you cannot manipulate, you cannot say, I'm going to move the moon a little bit away from the Earth and see what happens. Of course, sometimes we let the nature experiment, like there have been experiments in astronomy. There was an experiment that Einstein proposed, a thought experiment, that was actually conducted. It was an eclipse, and I think they really traveled. There was an expedition to the Andes in South America, where the eclipse would happen, where they would observe a phenomenon that was predicted by Einstein's theory. And they indeed observed that phenomenon, which is quite interesting, because Einstein's theory is not very intuitive for us. It was an experiment where the nature was playing the experimenter. It was actually, the nature was moving the, whatever, it was an eclipse, so maybe the moon was, nature was moving the moon in the path of the sun. You can imagine doing it yourself, but we cannot do it, right? But very often we cannot do experimentation. In economics, for example, we can do experimentations, but most experimentations are tragic. In communism, communism is a big experimentation in economy. They are screwing around with things, and the effect is typically terrible, hunger. There were so many people who died in the Soviet Union because of hunger. In China also, when they were experimenting with economics. There is a joke from the time of communism in Poland. If they introduce communism in Sahara Desert, there will be shortage of sand. Somehow they managed to just destroy everything. So even though you can experiment with economics, it's a very expensive experimentation, very risky. You don't want it. So the question is, can you do without experimentation? And yes, you can do a lot with just observing. Observation is just another way of learning about the world, right? We don't do experiments a lot, but we observe, and then we start asking questions, and sometimes we can do an experimentation, but sometimes we can infer something from observation. By the way, smoking and lung cancer, I have told you that there has never been an experiment that succeeded in causing lung cancer in animals, like rats, rabbits, or monkeys. Probably they live too short. They don't live long enough to develop lung cancer. And there has never been an experiment with causing lung cancer in humans, of course, because of ethical reasons. But today, I would find it very, very strange to hear somebody saying that there is no connection. We have established it through many observational studies. Essentially, observation is just another approach to doing science. It's not as strong as experimentation, but it also gives us data. Observation can sometimes eliminate rival hypotheses. If it eliminates every possible hypothesis, then the one that is left is essentially must be the truth. In observation, in the methods that I'm going to talk about today, assumptions are very important. But they are also important in experimentation. You also make assumptions. For example, if you remember, if we go back to this, we assume that the coin is that randomization worked. Of course, there is a non-zero probability that you get a very strange selection of your subjects, yes? That heads will be, by accident essentially, will turn out to be for those who get lung cancer, who are supposed to get lung cancer, or who will get lung cancer. So the randomization may not work correctly. We assume, but it's actually supported by a lot of statistics, that the probability of that that the groups are different is very, very low. Probability that they are the same when you use randomization is very, very high. But it's also an assumption that we assume that the randomization worked correctly. We also assume that if you do an experiment like this, that the subjects will follow your request to smoke or not to smoke. Yes, you assume that it's smoking tobacco and not something else. Yes, when we set up an experiment, we make a lot of assumptions. Admittedly, in observation, the assumptions are stronger. But the new methods are amazing. When I first saw, I gave a demo before you came. When I first saw it, I found it magic. How is that possible? From a data set, I can learn a causal graph. It's almost like magic. So the new methods are really squeezing the data to the limits. Who knows what the limits are? Maybe there's going to be more into the future. But the things that can be done with data analysis are just amazing. There are two approaches in science to learning Bayesian networks or causal discovery. We are going to spend most of the time on this first approach, because this first approach is the relationship between causality and probability, and the algorithms is much clearer. In the second approach, it's less clear. There is a theorem proving that under ideal circumstances, if you have a lot of data, if the noise is not too weird, that the two approaches will give us the same output, will discover the same causal graphs. But we are going to spend more time on this because it's easier to understand for humans first. So this first approach, called constraint search base, both of the approaches are based on search, a very computer science thing. This work is done by computer scientists, philosophers of science, and statisticians. It's really like the three areas coming together. So constraint search-based learning, this statement in most statistic textbooks, correlation does not imply causation, it is a true statement, of course, true and on the truth. Oops, I pressed something. But not the whole truth. You know, in this formula in the court of law, a witness swears, I'm going to tell truth, only truth, and nothing but truth. So I'm not, and all the truth, right? Truth, nothing but truth, and all the truth.
The whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Yes. So the whole truth is missing here. So for example, you know, I go to you, I hit you in your face, and you hit me back. And then I run to the police, look, he has hit me. I'm telling the truth, nothing but truth, but not the whole truth, right? That's lying, essentially. So, well, in this case, of course, it wasn't purposeful lying, but we have discovered in the meantime that this is not the whole truth. So, of course, correlation does not mean causation. We have, there may be causation between X and Y, X causes Y, but correlation may also be caused by Y causing X. Also, they are connected by a chain. There will be dependence. There can be a hidden common cause that we haven't observed that makes X and Y correlated, dependent. We also learned here that if you observe the common effect, then the causes can be dependent. So these are the four possibilities with just two variables. And indeed, you cannot say that whether there is a causation or not, it's just correlation. There are four possibilities. Of course, if we make assumptions, actually correlation can mean causation. Let me give you an example of assumptions. If I assume that I'm dealing only with two variables, nothing else outside, and I assume that X precedes Y in time, then this is the only possibility. Because causation doesn't work backwards. X happens before Y, so nothing outside, like here, then this is the only graph. So please note that assumptions sometimes will allow you to make stronger inferences. But we don't need to make such strong assumptions. Here is a case that kind of tells you more. So I don't know, I cannot guarantee that this is the whole truth, but this is more than that, just the basic truth. If you have the following thing, you have three variables, X, Y, and Z, and you know that X and Z are dependent. Let me show the picture so that it's easy. X and Z are dependent. You see they are connected. Y and Z are dependent. They are connected. X and Y are independent. There is no directed chain between them. There's no common cause. There's no way they can be dependent. But they become dependent if you condition on Z. Then they become dependent. If you are observing this pattern of four dependencies, then this is the only graph that fulfills that. There is no other graph, including three variables, that can explain this. And the proof is simple. How many graphs are there with three variables? I have drawn those graphs, right? Remember, it was for every pair of variables, you can have the arc one way, the other way, or no arc. So three possibilities. So you need to have 3 to the power of the number of pairs. If you have 3 variables, how many pairs do you have? 3 pairs. So 3 to the power of 3 gives us 27 graphs, minus 2 graphs that are cyclic. Cyclic graphs are excluded by assumption. So we have 25 graphs. You analyze each of the 25 graphs, and you notice that each of the 24 graphs violates some of these observations, but this graph fulfills all four. So this is the only graph that is possible if you observe something like this. So, correlation does not mean causation, but a group of correlations can actually mean causation. No other possibility than this. So, in this work of causal discovery from data, there are two important assumptions, axioms. Markov condition, we talked about it a lot. We talked about the implications that a graph has on the dependencies. So if you have a graph, you can actually read the independencies. This separation is a wise term used in this work, but it means essentially that the two variables are connected in the graph through one of the three rules that I showed you. Now, the second axiom, and Markov condition is not controversial, I think. There are counterexamples, but there's always a good response to them. The second assumption is more problematic, though. It says that, it is the implication the other way. If you observe independence in data, so you have a data set and there is no dependence in that between the two variables, then the assumption is that that is reflected in the graph also, is the consequence of the Markov conditions. And this assumption is more controversial. Here is one good counterexample. Is the existence of multiple paths. You stay up late before an exam. Each one of us has done it earlier, you know, at some point in our lives. We were young and healthy and didn't sleep much before an exam because we wanted to learn more. Of course, you learn more. That's a positive influence. And also the exam result is going to be better. So a positive influence of that path. Now, on the other hand, if you stay up before the exam, stay late, you are more tired. And because you are more tired, you make silly mistakes in the exam. Happened to each one of us, I bet. And it can happen that this positive path and this negative path will cancel out each other. In fact, I have prepared this as an example. With a graph, let me here, I think, let me open this up. This is the faithfulness violation. Here it is. So I selected that the numbers, they are 50-50 here. I selected them here myself. I selected them here in a, of course, malicious way. And also here, the parameters are such that if I stay up before the exam, I will learn more, but I will be more tired. But the effect on the performance is zero. If I generate data from this graph now, what I will notice is that in that data, staying up before an exam and exam performance are completely unrelated. They are not dependent on one another. Exam performance high tells me nothing about staying up. Yes? It makes a difference for those variables, but the two paths are canceling each other out. And why is this a problem? It is a problem because in many natural systems, there may be multiple connections. Not just one, but multiple connections. And if they cancel out each other, then you will not discover that. The assumption, the faithfulness assumption says, if I observe in my data that two variables are independent, then there should be no connection between them in the graph. That's what the assumption says. But look at that graph. Not only one connection is here, but there are two connections. So these two variables are connected strongly. But this possibility is excluded by assumption. The biggest problem in this faithfulness assumption is the existence of multiple paths. It's a problem. If there are multiple paths, they can cancel out each other. If I observe that this variable, then this path is very strong. Look. If I observe this, so I break that path by observing, this path is also very strong. Oops, I should be unobserved this one. So the path is strong. This one is also strong. But together, the effect cancels out. These are quite strong connections here. So now the argument in support of the faithfulness axiom is that, sure, it can happen that two things cancel out each other. But it is like in the joke with the tomahawk. I told you the joke about tomahawk, right? Very unlikely, essentially, because the numbers would have to be precisely such that the two paths are canceling each other out. So that's the argument supporting faithfulness condition. Of course, it's an argument, but it still remains a fact that faithfulness condition is somewhat problematic. How does this whole thing work? So we are dealing with, let's say, three variables. Here are all the possible networks, 25 of them. Some networks can be discovered by observing, looking at the data set and looking at the dependencies. Like in that example on the slide, we had four patterns of dependencies. And so we observe the dependencies, and from those dependencies, we can infer which graph it is. Sometimes it's possible to identify a unique graph, but that's only sometimes. There are situations where there are graphs that you cannot distinguish using just statistics. For example, this is a simple graph. This variable is independent of the two, but the same happens here. But these variables are dependent on one another, and that dependence does not disappear if I condition on the third variable. We don't know which way the connection goes. We may have made the assumption of, it's called satisfiability, I think, self-containment. There are no other variables outside. But still, we cannot distinguish using statistics between these two. This is an interesting case. These two variables, everything is dependent on everything here. But the dependence between these two variables disappears when you condition on the third one. But that happens when it's a common cause or a variable on the chain, one or the other way. So these three graphs are impossible to distinguish from one another. And these are, in general, all classes of distinguishability. You cannot distinguish using statistics between graphs within the same class. This in particular, everything is dependent on everything. The dependence does not disappear if you condition on any of the variables. And these are equivalence classes that you can distinguish from one another. Two theorems useful in the search for the causal structure. The first theorem called also skeleton theorem, says that there will be no edge between two variables x and y if and only if x and y are independent, given any subset of the variables. So if you can make two variables independent by conditioning or not conditioning, then that means that there is no connection between them. There is no direct connection. The second theorem is about the V-structures. If you have a triple like this, x, y, and z, z and x, z and x are not connected directly, x and z. They are not directly connected. And they are independent given some set of variables w. Then you can draw the direction of the connections if and only if that set w does not contain y. So if y is not in the conditioning set, then that makes x and z independent, then this is the graph. It's an important theorem that was proposed, I think, only in late 1980s, I think. How does it all work? The first stage of the algorithm is looking at the data and finding independences in the data. Once you have the independences, the rest is just logic. Just logical inference about what the set of structure is that could have generated the data. And here there are different algorithms. We are going to talk about the PC algorithm. PC is not a personal computer, it's they just invented a funny name. PC is for Peter and Clark. These are first names of the two authors of the algorithm, Peter and Clark. PC. Here is the PC algorithm. So, you know, the first stage is finding independences. That's easy. Look at every pair of variables and try to make those two variables independent. We'll look at an example in a moment. And the second is just logic. Here is the PC algorithm, pure logic. You start with a complete undirected graph. In the first step, you find adjacencies. For each pair of variables, if x and y are independent, given some subset of other variables, then you remove the edge. That's the first theorem. Essentially, there is no edge if the variables in question are independent. In the second step, you find the V-structures. V-structures are in the second theorem. These are the triples, x, y, z, in which you can make z and x dependent by conditioning on y. Why is it V structure? It's because we typically draw the causal graphs from the bottom to the from top to the bottom. And if you have x and y, or is it C? Y is in the middle. This resembles the letter B. That's why the name. They often refer to it as V structure. So this is the second theorem, the V-structure theorem. And then the third stage is just cleaning up, just avoiding new V-structures and avoiding cycles. Just cleaning up. The best way would be to explain this algorithm on an example. Let this be a causal graph that we want to discover. We don't know it, of course. It's somewhere we measure four variables only. And we want to discover the structure that connects those four variables. Let me try explain this in another way, maybe. I'm opening a data set. Here it is. I'm opening a data set that looks as follows. I have four variables measured, I have 10,000 records. So 10,000 instances of those four variables. That's my starting point. The underlying graph, of course, I showed it to you, but we don't know it. We don't know the graph. But one thing we can infer here is whether which things are independent. We can, just by looking at the graph with those three rules. One way of looking at it is that first theorem, if you remember. The variables are independent if and only if there is no connection between them. So there is no connection between A and B. How are they independent? Are they dependent? Sure, they are independent because there is no common cause and there is also no directed path between them. So they are independent. So this is the first independence that you see. There's also a second independence, second missing arrow here. That's an independence that you will see in the data. A and D are independent. Normally they are dependent, right? There's a path. A, C, D makes them dependent. To make them independent, you have to condition on C in order to break the path. So when you condition on C, A and D will be independent. Not yet. Because when you condition on C, then A and B become dependent. Yes, this is the V structure. You condition on C, all the ancestors of the common effect become dependent. If A and B are dependent, then A, B, D path is working here. A, B, D. So in order to make A and D independent, you have to condition on both C and B. And here are the independences. There are two independences in this data set. We don't know the graph, so we don't know it. We just have the data set, and in the data set we will observe these two independences. This is the first stage, looking at the data. And then logic. Trying to infer what kind of structure could have given rise to this kind of observations. We start the algorithm with first step, if you remember here. We begin with a complete undirected graph. Here it is. Undirected, every edge is without direction, without an arrow. And it's complete. Everything is connected with everything. First independence, this is the first step. A and B are independent, so you remove the connection A and B. Still, the first step, we have another independence. A and D are independent, conditional on BC. We will remove the arrow AD. And this already gives us the skeleton of the graph. So all the connections are here. We don't know the directions of the connections yet. But here are the connections. The skeleton after the first step. Second step, we are looking for the V structures. How many of them are there? Well, the triples. ACB is a V structure. Potential V structure. ACD is a potential V structure. BCD is not, because B and D have to be not connected directly. That's a precondition of the theorem. So there are only two potential V structures, ACB and ACD. Let's start with the first one, ACB. The precondition of the theorem, preconditions are fulfilled because in order to make A and B independent, you don't need to condition on C. So you are allowed by the theorem to orient the arcs A, C, and BC. That orientation. Now let's look at the second potential V-structure, ACD. Here the preconditions of the theorem are not satisfied because in order to make A and D independent, you need to condition on C. So C is not a variable that makes them dependent, it makes them independent. So you cannot orient the arc from D to C because it is not a V-structure. In the last step, we avoid the new V-structures and cycles. So we avoid this. If we oriented it from D to C, that would be wrong. A V-structure, that's not a V-structure. So we need to orient it from C to D. And in the last stage, this is also easy to orient because we cannot have a cycle. So it cannot be DB, it has to be BD in order to avoid a cycle. So in the end, the algorithm has discovered the original graph that generated the data. Let me show that in the program. We start with the data set. We pick an algorithm. I'm going to pick the PC algorithm. Okay. And the algorithm postulates the graph, which is exactly the graph that has generated the data. It's just a nice example. Learn the parameters. I bet. We didn't see it here, but sometimes it's not possible to discover the graph. Let me, in fact, show it to you. I'm going to open. Indistinguishability. Let this be the original graph that I want to discover. And this is a data set that I generated from the graph. If this is the graph, then let me show it as a icon. US size to fit text. Okay. Let me save it here. So let this be the graph that generated the data. And please note that this graph is impossible to identify uniquely because it is in the class of three graphs. A, Y, Z is the first instance. Z, Y, X. And then Y being a common cause of X and Z. All three graphs will generate the same data, exactly the same data. They are not going to be possible to distinguish automatically. What happens when you try to run discovery on this model, on this data set? I'm using the PC algorithm. The algorithm has correctly indicated that X and Y are connected, Y and Z are connected. Please note, we cannot see the original graph, that it's compatible with that graph. But unfortunately, we don't know which way the connection goes. We don't know which way the arrow has to be. So this is essentially a representation of a class of graphs that that the algorithm was able to discover. So this is exactly what this slide is about. PC outputs a pattern, a graph containing directed, bidirectional, and undirected edges. Directed edge means that every graph in this class has a directed edge here. Bidirectional, well, undirected, like what you saw in a moment, means that this is actually wrong. I just discovered this is a wrong thing on the slide. red undirected edge means that there is a connection, but we don't know which way. And when it's two arrowheads on a arc, then there is a connection, or there is a common cause. If there is a connection, we don't know which way it goes, or there is a common cause, hidden common cause. Sometimes PC algorithm is able to detect the common hidden common cause. How do you deal with errors here? Of course, it's a search, and errors can be made. If you remember, the first phase of this algorithm is of this discovery process is finding independences in the data. Independences are tested using classical statistical tests. Classical tests have some alpha level, alpha value. H0, traditionally, is the status quo or independence hypothesis. So we assume that the variables are independent, and we are testing that independence from the data at significance level alpha. If we make alpha very low, very, very low, it's going to be very difficult to reject H0 independence. So the graph is going to be sparse, because most of the connections are going to be declared to be independent. If you make alpha high, it's going to be easy to reject independence, so the graph will contain a lot of connections. And this will be the last slide today, because then, I'll have to return to the two slides next week anyway. But let me show you this example, this idea of playing with the alpha level. I'll repeat it again next week for sure, because it's an important thing. Let me open a data set in Gini. This data set is real. Oh, I cannot do it because there is a dialog open. Sorry. What I wanted to do today, since we just have 3 minutes left, I wanted to show you that idea of playing with the alpha level. If I'm learning a graph from this data set, the default alpha value is 5%. If I learn it, I'm going to get a class of graphs, of course. You can see that it's impossible to discover the graph uniquely, so the algorithm gave me a class of graphs in which I have directed arcs. This means that there is, in every graph of this class, there's a directed arc between these two variables. Then we have red arcs, which say, there is an arc, but we don't know which way the arc goes, this way or that way. We don't know it. And then double-edged arcs say there is a connection or there is a common cause, a hidden common cause. If there is a connection directly, then we don't know which way it goes. It can be either way. In any case, we have a class of graphs. I'm going back to learning to change the significance level. Let me make it absurdly low, like one in a million, one in a gazillion, let's say. When I do that now, please note that the graph is sparse. Because the significance level is very low, it's difficult to reject independence. When I go to and change the significance level to absurdly high, 20%, that's a very high significance level, I'm going to get a dense graph. Still, the graph is not complete, so even at this level, I wasn't able to reject independence in some cases. Like these two variables don't have a connection, direct connection, that means that they are independent. So even at this level, I was not able to reject independence, even though it was very easy to reject. The interesting thing is, we will have to come back to this example, because I want to show you a few important things in this context. It's already 10 past 7. You cannot see it here, but it's 10 past 7. So this is as good moment as any to make this, to interrupt today's class. We have the entire class next week to talk more about causal discovery, to play with examples. If any of you has interesting data that you would like to try these methods on, send them to me. I'll treat them with confidence. We can play with these data here in the classroom. If you don't have any data, I have a couple of artificial data sets that we can play with.
The name of the application?
Genie. If you want Genie, if you want to play with it, it's a commercial product. I'm involved in it. It's a company called Base Fusion LLC. It's an American company. I'm one of the two partners. We on the bottom, about us. Two partners. Both of them are in Poland now, me and my research programmer. We developed this program at the University of Pittsburgh, but at some point, 11 years ago, we bought a license, and now we are developing it further and selling through the company. In any case, the software is free for academic use. If you go to downloads and go to academic downloads, you need to log in, and that's a requirement because we cannot allow people in North Korea and Iran and Crimean Peninsula to use that software, so you have to log on. These are four different social networks. We don't do anything. The only thing we get is the name and address and the email address from that. And then you download and install Genie. Genie Academic is identical to the commercial version, the same functionality. The only thing is that it comes only with the 32-bit version, not 64-bit. But for most practical applications, it's really enough. So you can download it from here and play with it. If you want, you can, in fact, I don't even need your data. What you can do is you can connect your laptop here and we can together look at your data. If you have data to analyze in your work, in your research, by all means bring the data. We can see what we can do. Try to read the data in Genie. There is a format. You can read about the format, about how it works. There is an online help. And the important section is this, using Genie and learning. Everything that you would like to know about the data format and structured learning, the algorithms, everything is in this chapter section. So, it will be actually very useful for you, I think, if we can play with real data next week. Great. So thank you very much, and I'll see you next week. We have only three classes left, I think. Total of three classes. We will finish by the end of May.
Thank you.
Thank you.